Me, oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
It's the return of Western Skies, a monthly news and culture magazine that takes a look at issues facing Colorado in the West. This month, we're talking about Mother Nature. We'll hear from Colorado's climatologist.
We as human beings want the same amount of moisture, but nature doesn't work that way.
Explore the causes behind Trinidad area earthquakes.
I can't say that that's what's causing it. I can't say they're not causing it. There's no proof.
And wax poetic about a ditch.
That's where the Indians, as they would be coming over the mesa, they would look for the creek, and that's where they camped.
All that and more coming up on this edition of Western Skies. We'll be right back. Thanks for tuning in to Western Skies, a collaboration between the news department and the Big Something here at KRCC. I'm Andrea Chalfin. Mother Nature affects us all, and no matter how much we want the weather to remain consistent, it's always changing. This month, we take a look at the weather, climate, and natural disasters in the region, and at least one way in which we've changed that which Mother Nature intended. Our roundtable this month features Jennifer Stark, who is the meteorologist in charge at the National Weather Service office in Pueblo, Matthew Kruger, broadcast meteorologist with Fox 21 in Colorado Springs, and Nolan Deskin, state climatologist for Colorado at Colorado State University. Nolan joins us from the studios of KCSU in Fort Collins, and we begin with him explaining the difference between weather and climate.
There's lots of analogies that you can use, and one of them would be that weather is the clothes you choose to wear today, and climate is the wardrobe that you have in your closet. So what you need to cover the whole spectrum of what weather can dish out through the seasons and over the years. So the weather is the now and what's coming up, and the climate is the whole range of possibilities that we've seen for many years of past experience.
Jennifer?
For us, we really focus in on the first 7 days of the forecast. But there are different parts of NOAA and the National Weather Service that do some climate prediction, looking out up to 14 months in advance, and give people kind of an outlook of what to expect. But primarily in the National Weather Service forecast office, we are looking at from the starting point, the minute we walk in the door, giving a very detailed forecast for the first 24 hours and additional information out for the next several days.
Matthew?
I'll say as a broadcaster, climate doesn't matter as much, you know, getting that information out to the public. It's really the weather that's happening right now. Climate becomes useful when you compare whatever the weather is to whatever climatological weather is.
And what's the general weather and climate for southern Colorado here?
Wow, that's a broad question,
Jennifer.
Because we have a little bit of everything. We have winter weather, we have severe convective weather, thunderstorms.
What does that mean?
Convective weather is thunderstorms, and severe, we define that as thunderstorms that have 1-inch diameter hail or larger and or produce wind gusts of 60 miles per hour or greater, or it can be a tornado-producing thunderstorm. That could be severe thunderstorm as well. So, you know, we just run the gamut here in southern Colorado. We can have a mix of all three types of weather on any given day. We can have the mountain areas of our forecast area having a winter weather event, the plains maybe having a fire weather threat, and then some areas of the plains perhaps having severe thunderstorms. So it's a very, very complex setup for forecasters to deal with, and oftentimes you get anything and everything on any given day.
Matthew?
It's extremely diverse down here. We have our banana belts, which we often talk about, one of those being the Upper Arkansas Valley around Salida, Buena Vista, which because of their location, their climatology is going to be just a little bit different. You know, they're going to average less snow and warmer temperatures during the winter than places just barely outside, a few miles outside these towns, even around Canyon City. You know, that's a more difficult place to forecast for me, simply because it's a little bit closer to the mountains, but it kind of sits in an area where it's shadowed a little bit, in some cases with snow. Then you've got the Eastern Plains, which are going to be extremely diverse too. So to pinpoint and to make a blanket statement about what the weather or climate is for Southern Colorado, in one word, diverse.
Nolan, what goes into making it such a diverse area of climate in Southern Colorado?
Consider the distance that Southern Colorado is from the Pacific Ocean. That's the primary source of winter moisture. And there's a whole lot of mountain ranges upstream and often a storm track that is not favorable for bringing Pacific storms to Southeast Colorado. But when things are just right, the Gulf of Mexico is still a long way away, but it's closer to Southeast Colorado than any other part of Colorado. So when conditions are right, the slow-moving storm spinning across New Mexico, pulling the moisture up across Texas and Oklahoma, packing it up against the southern front range, voila, the ingredient for very big storms, some of the time, dry most of the time. And of course, so it's those very factors, the high elevation, the complex terrain, and the distance from the moisture sources of the Pacific and the Gulf.
So let us expand a little bit more on this terrain.
For forecasters dealing with the mountains and analyzing storms that come over the mountains, there's always the concern of how much moisture is going to accompany a storm system, how much of that moisture is going to be wrung out as it crosses the mountain ranges, and how much is going to be left once it comes across the plains. Another issue with the rapid changes in elevation, like the Palmer Divide on the north side of El Paso County, you have the Rampart Range and Pikes Peak to the west. Then on the east side of El Paso County, the terrain is much lower. And then as you travel further south in El Paso County, you're going downhill as you go into the Arkansas River Valley. So all of those things have an important role to play as we have a storm system in the area. What prevailing wind direction is going to impact the area? If it's coming from a northerly direction, we know the Palmer Divide's probably going to get some precipitation, maybe some snowfall if it's wintertime. If it's an easterly direction, then we might see a little more snowfall across El Paso County. So it's just extremely, extremely difficult to forecast for. In addition to that, the numerical and computer models just do not handle that terrain and that change in terrain very well, because their resolution, the scale that they're at, just cannot resolve those changes in elevation.
Yeah, you know, mountains can act as a shield. Moisture coming in directly from the west, we all know west winds all over the Front Range of Colorado are downslope winds, and that means that moisture has a real tough time making it over those mountains. And if we have strong enough westerly winds, it actually dries us out. On the flip side of that, an easterly wind is the exact opposite, particularly for El Paso County. A southeast wind typically brings us a little bit more moisture for the opposite reason. All that moisture, low-level moisture, comes up against the mountains, can't quite make it over the mountains, so it just kind of pools in along the Front Range. That could produce anything from low clouds, fog, to snow. That's some of our biggest snowfalls have come from easterly winds. What's sometimes frustrating and sometimes it's very difficult to forecast exactly where that wind direction is going to come from. Any slight change in that wind direction can throw off the forecast quite a bit, especially in the wintertime with snowfall.
Well, we're thinking, because it's still winter, we're thinking in winter mode, but the game changes as you get into summer. And every day, the ingredient for storms is present in that there's the mountain areas, the high elevations heat up fast, convective updrafts form early, and the ingredient that is the most key ingredient to whether something happens or not ends up being whether we have moisture available. And often beginning around the first, second, third week of July, something happens, low-level moisture increases, and daily thunderstorm activity develops. And we don't see the same patterns in northern Colorado. Watching these summer convective patterns where the storms are very isolated, but yet where they begin to form is totally affected by that topography. What I pay particular attention to in southeast Colorado, northern New Mexico, is the infrequent but nevertheless always present opportunity for extreme rains from really May through even late April through early October. The potential is there, but it's strongest in July, August, and September for the incredibly intense localized storms. There are historic records of up to a foot or more of rain in less than a day. And with the terrain that you have there, the consequences can be grave.
Just following up on that, you're right. We are still kind of in winter mindset, but here before too long, we're going to be talking more and more about thunderstorms and preparing for severe weather season. And what I like to tell people is that we need three basic ingredients for thunderstorms to form, and that is a source of lift, so lifting that air, a source of moisture, and instability in the atmosphere, meaning that if the air is lifted, it wants to continue rising. So just having that mountains there, that topography, you already have a source of lift to get thunderstorms beginning. And sometimes we can just have meager amounts of moisture in the atmosphere and still have thunderstorms develop. They may not produce a lot of rainfall. And in those cases, they may produce lightning. And without that wetting rainfall, then we have some fire weather concerns or fire concerns as they maybe ignite fires on the plains or even in the mountains. So it's always an interesting setup here during the summer season, and certainly flash flooding, thunderstorm producers are a big threat and a big concern, because also with our interesting topography, when we have that heavy rainfall, it's going to run downhill, it's going to fill up the creeks and streams very, very rapidly.
With that flooding, the flip side is the fact that we've been dealing with drought. Talk a little bit about the drought that's happening in southern Colorado here. Nolan?
Well, first of all, drought happens. You look at the historic records, and we have data from southeast Colorado that date back to the 1870s. And drought, defined as well below average precipitation for anything from a few months to even a few years, happens on a not a predictable cycle, but on a very regular basis, so that rarely do you go more than 20 or 30 years without a really major multi-year drought. The drought that we experienced last year, 2011, was a part of this incredible, intense drought from northern Mexico all the way across New Mexico, eastern Arizona, and practically the entire state of Texas. And while it dropped off abruptly as you got north, you had to get north of the Arkansas Valley before you got to that transition line to more normal climate conditions. There's a lot of concern that this drought is not over yet, but we don't have much skill in making long-range predictions like that. But the one thing we know is we rely on the precipitation that falls from the sky, and that precipitation is extremely variable. The difference between a very wet year and a very dry year will be perhaps a factor of four. Kind of a rule of thumb for the Great Plains is that your wettest year could easily be double your average, and your driest year will be less than half of your average. And yet we as human beings want the same amount of moisture, but nature doesn't work that way. So drought is a part of this cycle.
Well, if it's a part of a cycle, as you're saying, then how does this current cycle that people are suggesting that 2011 is a part of this cycle compare to previous significant drought events in the area?
The drought of 2011, possibly continuing, although not as severe right now, is surprisingly, as severe as it seems, is still fairly easy going compared to the drought just a few years ago in 2002, one of Colorado's driest years in recorded history. And this drought period, as significant as it seems, is relatively short compared to the droughts of the observed past, of the 1950s, which lasted about 5 years, of the 1930s, which lasted nearly a decade with a couple of sharp interruptions and to squeeze in some major floods as well. So again, it seems cyclical, It comes and goes, but yet it's not a predictable cycle, so I cannot tell you what's going to happen next.
It can be localized too. And some of the factors that we look at may even be a little misleading in some ways. For example, last September, you know, El Paso County at the official recording location, which is the airport in Colorado Springs, picked up 4.5 inches of rain, I believe, something like that.
It was over 5.
Over five, yeah.
Unbelievable. So obviously for the yearly total, since that's the official climate location, it's going to look a little bit better. It's going to make the year's rainfall record look a lot better, because that accounts for about a quarter of our normal climatological precipitation for the year. Other sides of the city that didn't see that convective precipitation are going to still be in a pretty powerful drought. Keep in mind, of that 5 inches that fell too, a lot of that just ran off. And so we didn't see the benefits from it had that moisture been spread out over a couple weeks, per se. So even though last year didn't end up as bad in Colorado Springs on paper, except for, you know, those couple days in September, it was still a pretty dry year. Pueblo, of course, didn't see that. And so the drought persisted there quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer?
One of the alarming things about last year was, in our office, as we're doing forecasting and looking at the upcoming weather, we always expect some fairly strong storms in the late winter and spring months. And we did not see that last year. And I think that was particularly alarming. And that's when we really identify this is a very dry situation. We're going into the warm, dry summer without the benefit of having that spring snowstorms or that spring moisture that we normally expect.
Nolan, as the climatologist for Colorado, what are the multiple factors that sort of go into the changing climate, and the what do you sort of see for Colorado in the future, and where are we now, and potentially nationally and worldwide as well? That's a really big question.
I was going to say, what a question that is. but I'm very accustomed to answering questions, or at least facing questions, not always answering them that well, about what the future looks like and what the past has taught us. And we've always thought that our past data that we've tracked, and again, for Southeast Colorado, 130, almost 140 years of data in a few places, gives us a pretty good sense of how it varies from year to year, the wet periods, the dry periods, the hot episodes, the cold. But do we know for sure that that's how it's going to unfold into the future? Well, we don't. We know that computer models based on projections of ever-increasing greenhouse gases suggest that warming is a part of our future. And I'd very much like to be able to confidently tell you how that's going to play out. I don't know for sure how that will play out, but I know to a first approximation that the summer that you experienced in Southeast Colorado this past year, 2011, would be very likely a normal summer just a few decades from now if these computer models are anywhere as close to correct, and that we'll see more of those very warm and perhaps very dry summers, and it's a little bit disconcerting. But do I know that for a fact? No, I don't. I just know that that's the most likely scenario from the best of what we think we know about the climate and our ability to model it. But I need to say right away that climate variability, the year-to-year changes, are what affect us the most. That 1999 to 2002 transition was huge, and its impact on society, on agriculture, on water planners was huge. And that's going to always be a part of our climate, these variations, because that's how the system works. It's not stable.
Jennifer, I see you nodding your head.
Well, I think, you know, my background is that I'm a meteorologist. I'm not a climate scientist. But the conclusion by many climate scientists that have examined this is that we are warming. The global temperature is warming. And I think, like Nolan said, I just echo that. We really don't know how that's going to evolve. We have to examine these things as they evolve with time and keep analyzing the data, keep improving our computer models, keep improving the data that goes into the computer models, and do our best from there.
There's so many factors that go into it. So to make a blanket statement is really tough to do. The good thing is our ability to forecast long range is getting better. There's still a long way to go. But climatologically, with the data continuously changing, I think the biggest difference probably in some of the temperatures I believe that I read up on, especially around Colorado Springs, you know, we're seeing our overnight lows pretty much across the board a little bit warmer than they have been climatologically. Short term, how is that going to affect us? You know, there's so many factors that go into it. So it's more of a wait and see type approach. In the meantime, you know, we're going to do our best to give you a good short term forecast.
That was Nolan Deskin, state climatologist for Colorado, Matthew Kruger, broadcast meteorologist for Fox 21 in Colorado Springs, and Jennifer Stark, the meteorologist in charge at the National Weather Service in Pueblo. We talked about a lot of topics that simply didn't make it to air, things like tornadoes, La Niña, and springtime winds. You can hear the full conversation online at krcc.org. We'll be right back with more Western Skies. Welcome back to Western Skies. I'm Andrea Chalfin. Since 1936, American farmers and gardeners have been able to select plants best tailored for their land by using the Plant Hardiness Zone Map. That's produced by the Agricultural Research Service, a branch of the USDA. The map uses average extreme low temperatures to divide the nation into climate zones. The 2012 version of the hardiness map included significant changes both in findings and in methods of measuring. KRCC's Kate Januska researched the new map's local significance.
We're hardy sorts here. You know, spring is right around the corner, you know.
It's a frigid late February morning at Harlan Wolf Ranch, a community garden in Colorado Springs managed by Pikes Peak Urban Gardens. Larry Stebbins is the director.
We've got a 6 to 8 inch layer of straw, and then you can see we have a screen on top so it doesn't blow.
The land under Stebbins' feet, along with most of the Colorado Springs area, is currently classified as Zone 6A in the U.S. government's Plant Hardiness Zone map. That means it can reach an extreme low of 5 to 10 degrees below zero. Overall, the hardiness map consists of 13 climate zones. One ranks as the coldest, think northern Alaska, and 13 is the warmest, think Hawaii. Each zone of 10 degrees variance is further divided into A and B subsections. While Colorado Springs is classified as 6A, that's not as cold as the region's previous classification, Stebbins says. The last map came out in 1990 and had the city as one category colder.
Now, Colorado Springs is apparently 6A hardiness zone, which means it's a little warmer than it used to be. And what does that all mean for us here? Well, it means about a 5 degree warmer winter.
Stebbins' own observations and this new map show him a small piece of evidence for climate change. In the 25 years he's gardened in Colorado, Stebbins says he's seen warming that causes fall harvest to become significantly longer, up to 7 to 10 days longer than in the 1980s. On this year's new hardiness map, zones shifted visibly north, or warmer, compared to the 1990 map. Even so, USDA Agricultural Research Service spokeswoman Kim Kaplan says jumping to the conclusion of climate change is problematic.
If you're looking for evidence of global climate change, this is a very weak way to go about doing it. There are just too many differences between what is considered fact for global climate change and this, which is really about weather.
Weather is a shorter-term phenomenon. Climate, on the other hand, is long-term and simply not measurable via this map, says Kaplan. Additionally, only 13 years of weather data was used to create the 1990 map. 30 years of data was analyzed for the 2012 version. To truly measure longer-term climate, Kaplan says her climatologists would have wanted to study a solid century of information at minimum. Kaplan notes that rather than being evidence of warming, some interpretations of the 2012 map show that the 1990 map may actually have been drawn a shade too cold.
One of the things we found very interesting is that this map, the 2012 map, looks a lot more like the 1960 map than it does the 1990 map. The 1990 map was based largely on data from the 70s, which was a very, very cold decade. Was that map reflective of cooling?
Rather than as a result of climate change, Kaplan says that thanks to improved technology and research methods used to create the new map, it's logical that many areas switch zones because the new numbers are simply more accurate.
We created that algorithm or equation that weighted a whole bunch of geographic factors like elevation and slope of land and prevailing winds and the nearness of large bodies of water. And then the computer drew the lines between actual weather reporting stations using each of those weighted factors. That makes this map so much more accurate than anything before it.
The map was then ground-proofed with help from weather experts nationwide. Now internet-friendly, the map can also zoom down to precise one-half-mile areas. That kind of accuracy is especially useful in mountainous areas like Colorado, because the map shows the fast-changing rings of climate zones as elevation rises to the mountain peaks. Kaplan says the public reaction to the map has been phenomenal.
Well, in the first two-week report of usage, we know we had more than 20 million hits.
Especially popular is the front-page zip code search, which reveals the climate zones of one specific neighborhood. That helps gardeners chart the best possible plants and planting schedule for their land. That's who the map is designed for, says Kaplan. Back at Harlan Wolf Ranch, Stebbins says he uses the hardiness map to help plan gardens. If we do, in fact, have an extra 5 degrees of warmth, at least as a gardener, he welcomes the news.
There's a few crops that are on the borderline of between a 5B and a 6A. And for us, that's exciting because we get a chance to grow some things that we may not have had a chance before.
He lists varieties of apple, peach, and apricot. Delicate perennial herbs like tarragon and rosemary, and even artichokes, which are sensitive to winter lows. Back out in the February air, it doesn't feel any warmer, and Stebbins makes sure not to get too excited about all the new borderline plants it might be possible to grow. In the end, he says, Colorado's challenge isn't frigid temperatures, but rather fluctuating ones.
In Colorado Springs, since our elevation is well over a mile high, we do experience some extremes in weather, and it comes on quickly. But, you know, that's just part of the challenge, and it's kind of fun to meet that challenge and see if we can outwit Mother Nature.
Both Kaplan and Stebbins agree on one piece of advice. Whatever a map says, even a map as precise as the plant hardiness zone map, a gardener's knowledge about what thrives and fails in his or her own garden trumps any outsider's zone classification. For KRCC News, I'm Kate Janeska.
You can see the new map online at krcc.org. When people think about earthquakes, Colorado isn't exactly the first place that comes to mind. But in the past couple decades, the Trinidad region has experienced a surprising number of seismic events. Scientists and locals alike are wondering just what is causing them. KRCC's Michelle Mercer reports.
Just before midnight on August 22nd last year, Mary Apodaca experienced what she calls the biggest shock of her life.
All of a sudden, I just felt my bed shake. I thought I was going to go down with the wall and the bed down the hill. When I got up, I seen stuff that was on my dressers on the floor. My dressers were open.
Apodaca lives west of Trinidad, near the small towns of Valdez and Segundo. This puts her just a couple miles from the epicenter of August 5.3 magnitude earthquake. The quake wasn't the area's first, but it was its biggest, and Colorado's largest in 44 years. Dr. Harley Benz monitors global earthquake activity from the United States Geological Survey's National Earthquake Information Center in Golden.
In the case of southern Colorado, we don't know what are the causes of all these earthquakes. It's something that has to be looked into. It's quite complicated.
The Trinidad area has a documented history of earthquake activity dating back to the 1960s, which is when the first sensitive measurements were taken. But ask Valdez and Segundo residents what caused this jarring seismic event, and there's almost universal agreement.
Everybody says they don't know, but I think it's the fracking and all that.
That's what I heard.
Drilling, way too much.
It's gas drilling and fracking.
There's certainly plenty of natural gas production in the area. From her living room window, Mary Apodaca has a bird's-eye view of Pioneer Natural Resources Trinidad Field Office. The landscape around her place is marked by wells. But Apodaca is not so sure natural gas production is to blame for the earthquake.
I can't say that that's what's causing it. I can't say they're not causing it. There's no proof.
Apodaca's opinion on the earthquake's cause is also the official position of the United States Geological Survey. For now, anyway.
We have some examples now of where earthquakes are occurring very close to injection sites, particularly areas where we have not had known activity. Youngstown, Ohio is a good example, perhaps Guy, Arkansas.
If gas production did cause the 2011 Trinidad earthquake, it would have been through a side effect, the disposal of millions of gallons of wastewater in injection wells that reach deep into the earth. Wastewater could migrate to rock formations, greasing a fault, so to speak, and allowing it to slip. It is entirely possible, Dr. Ben says, that natural and man-made conditions combine to create the August quake.
If you add fluids to a fault, it's more likely to fail, and you see tectonic earthquakes.
But to prove an earthquake was caused by fluid disposal, you have to accurately locate it near an injection site. Pioneer Resources, XTO, and El Paso, three major natural gas companies in the Trinidad region, all declined to be interviewed for this story. In an email statement, though, Pioneer did say the company thinks the, quote, margin for error in locating events still leaves too much uncertainty for proper scientific analysis. That was the case with measurements in the past, says Mark Maramonte with the USGS. Back in 2001, a swarm of smaller earthquakes hit Trinidad, getting everyone's attention.
The earthquakes were poorly located with the permit network that we had at the time. They were easily off by plus or minus 10 to 15 kilometers.
But during that 2001 swarm, the USGS installed a number of seismometers in the area, and those were still in place during the 2011 event. Harley Benz.
With the instrumentation we have down there, our accuracy is probably on the order of hundreds of meters from where the earthquakes are occurring.
That's accurate enough to establish any proximity of earthquakes to gas company injection sites. There are a few other factors, the rate of wastewater injection, for example. But the USGS is confident that they'll be able to sort out natural and induced causes for the 2011 earthquake. Scientists are analyzing the data now. Stonewall Fire Protection District Chief Lloyd Holloman responded to emergency calls on the night of the August quake. Chief Holloman drove me around Valdez and Segundo to survey the damage and recovery there. Many of the hardest hit buildings were adobe structures dating to the 19th century. The earthquake caused an estimated $300,000 in damage.
We're kind of in the heart of the community of Valdez. This house we're coming up to here on the left belongs to a gentleman by the name of Charlie Gums. It suffered quite a bit of damage. It was falling out into the driveway here.
Well, it shook us out of bed, and we got up and got flashlights and started looking around. That's when part of the house was coming down. This whole wall.
Gums has rebuilt the front wall of his house. To help with his $33,000 repair bill, he says he got a low-interest loan through the South Central Council of Governments. Gums seems philosophical about the possibility that there was a man-made cause for his trouble.
What are you going to do? Just live with it.
Chief Holloman says that kind of attitude is common among local residents, and only natural in an area where industry has played a complicated role for generations.
Most of these people through here that have jobs are probably employed through the coal bed methane production. If you look there along the roadway, well, there's coal seams right there. So we've had a lot of coal mining. That's the history of this area. This whole area has had boom and bust times.
The U.S. Geological Survey expects to have some conclusions about what caused the 2011 Trinidad earthquakes in April. For KRCC News, I'm Michelle Mercer.
We'll be right back with more Western Skies.
Thank you.
Western Skies.
Welcome back to Western Skies. I'm Andrea Chalfin. You won't hear much disagreement among the residents of Pleasant Valley on the west side of Colorado Springs when you ask them their opinions about the roughly mile-long concrete ditch that runs down the middle of their west side neighborhood at the foot of Garden of the Gods Park. The Big Something's Noel Black takes a closer look in this piece. A ditch runs through it.
It's ugly. It's always been ugly.
I mean, it's got spooge and trash in there.
I think this ditch is ugly.
Cracked and rotting and breaking away, and it's a nightmare.
I lived across the street from the ditch on 31st Street, too, as a teenager, from 1986 to 1990. My mother and her partner still live there, and though I agree with the residents of Pleasant Valley that the ditch stands as a painfully ugly landmark with almost nothing beyond its undeniable existence and functional use as a stormwater drainage to redeem it, I still remember it fondly and the way, each season, it seemed to hint at some faint memory of nature. Spring, host for aesthetically indifferent mallards and their chartreuse ducklings in its clumps of trash and volunteer horsetails. Summer, trapezoidal gray playpen for the neighborhood children who slid down the mossy drop toward the gaping black mouth of the tunnel at Bijou Street. Fall, dyspeptic and ungainly, but still oozing a brown, river-like trickle of water between elm saplings that shot up from between the cracks in the cobbled concrete. Winter, surly old swallower of cars when the roads were slick with ice. Only recently, some two decades later, did I hear the rumor that the ditch, the horrible, wonderful 31st Street ditch of my adolescence that even then seemed as old and inevitable as time itself, had not always been so. It had been a creek once, like our own little Los Angeles River, and like a fallen man longing for a lost Eden, I set out to find it.
Why was it named Camp Creek? And the reason for that was that's where the Indians, as they would be coming over the mesa, they would look for the creek, and that's where they camped. So that's where the name came from, Camp Creek.
That's Ron Wright, president of Rockledge Ranch Living History Association. Born and raised on the west side of Colorado Springs and now in his 70s, he remembers when the ditch was, as he and his friends called it, Little Deer Creek, a tree-lined stream full of small fish that ran down from Queens Canyon above Garden of the Gods down through the apple orchards of Rockledge Ranch. Fish.
And once in a while from Fountain Creek, you could even see some trout in there and catch them too. And it was just a nice play area for the kids and for everybody, picnics and everything else going on where now the streets are.
There's an aerial photograph from 1958 in the archives of the Pikes Peak Library District from just before the neighborhood got developed, where you can see the snaking, shady banks of Camp Creek as it wound down through the valley toward Fountain Creek. It's difficult to imagine how anyone could have paved it over. But because it was a creek, it was also a floodplain, and when the neighborhood began to develop in the late 1950s and early 60s.
Broman Homes developed it out, and they needed the drainage better because of the floods and things like that. It was periodical. But
they needed it if they were going to build homes.
Yeah, right. It needed all of the drainage to be taken care of to affect any kind of building and stuff.
The rights to the water that once filled the creek were sold to Kissing Camel's Estates, says Wright, and the neighborhood became what it is today. They paved paradise and put up a ditch. But even with this channel there to whisk away any sudden walls of water, there have been a number of floods that have exceeded its capacity. The most recent, in 1999, spilled into basements of homes all along 31st Street. Frank and Barbara Sanders, residents of Pleasant Valley for over 35 years, live near the top of the ditch, where it almost washed out entirely that year.
You don't think about it much until it overflows.
The couple show me a photo album filled with pictures of collapsed concrete slabs that washed out and cracked like so many saltine crackers.
It came with such force, though, that the rocks, you know, the rocks out there by 31st Street just washed those right out.
Wow.
You can hear rocks rolling on the bottom of the creek.
Many Pleasant Valley residents, like Kent Russell, a real estate appraiser originally from Houston, Texas, would love to see the ditch return to something like its natural state. Russell says that renaturalizing and re-engineering the ditch to accommodate larger storms would automatically add $10,000 to $15,000 of value to each of the homes along the floodplain. But ultimately, he says, you can't put a price on the aesthetic benefit.
You know, it's just, it's better for value. You know, nobody wants to be across from a ditch. It's just
Ryan Lloyd, an architect and recent transplant from Oregon who bought a home near the foot of the ditch 3 years ago, agrees. He thinks the city vastly underestimates the potential attraction of a renaturalized waterway at the foot of Garden of the Gods and cites the wildly popular creation of Waterfront Park in Portland.
And they tore the freeway out, which everyone thought was a horrible idea because it would snarl traffic and ruin the city. And what it did is create one of the most popular places in the country.
Sadly for those who hope to see Camp Creek resurrected from its concrete tomb, the ditch was slated for a nearly $15 million redesign in 2011 before the stormwater enterprise was shut down in 2010. But now the 31st Street ditch is one of just dozens of neglected stormwater sites that won't withstand a 100-year flood, says Lisa Ross, acting stormwater manager for the City of Colorado Springs.
We have over $500 million in projects that need to take place. And, you know, that list is, if you don't address some of these issues and they become bigger and bigger, obviously the dollar value goes up. So what might be a maintenance activity that's on our list now, you know, could ultimately become a much larger project as things fail.
Though Ross says the ditch would still likely be a top priority for redesign in the event that stormwater funding is restored in the near future, she's not optimistic that it'll happen anytime soon, and the price tag will undoubtedly be a lot higher. Ron Wright, who played along the banks of Camp Creek as a child, remains sanguine in his pessimism about its future.
I don't think it'll ever happen. I think it'll just remain a ditch.
And if it doesn't, well...
You know, ironically, it always made the neighborhood stick out in my mind.
Kent Russell.
I always thought, one day I'm going to live in that neighborhood. And, you know, it's weird that the ditch being something that I think is negative would get me to want to move here, but it's what made me always remember the neighborhood.
In the meantime, Camp Creek seems to have its own designs on the ditch. I keep an eye on it when I come to visit my mom. It's still winter, but clumps of watercress already thicken in the meandering little pools where the concrete bottom is now completely covered over with dirt and grass. A mallard spooks and flies off toward Garden of the Gods. A soggy Justin Bieber poster, an old couch cushion, and the crumbling pavement here may be unsightly, but in the end, they don't stand a chance against this persistent little trickle of water.
The Pleasant Valley residents quoted at the beginning of this piece were Star Ballier, James Corcoran, Steve Berger, and Joel Lee. You can listen to the piece again and watch a slideshow of images, past and present, at our website, krcc.org. And finally, on Memorial Day 1935, Colorado Springs was inundated by the largest flood ever to hit the region when a series of thunderstorms filled Monument and Fountain Creeks to their capacity and beyond. The Big Something's Craig Richardson explores the pages of the Colorado Springs Gazette following the disaster.
Twelve persons apparently were dead and six others were listed as missing last night, as Colorado Springs counted the toll of floodwaters that roared down Monument Creek, wreaking hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of property damage and isolating the city. In Colorado Springs, the rainfall yesterday totaled 2.34 inches, the Colorado College Weather Observatory reported. The downpour brought the total to 7.19 inches. The ravaged area, embracing Monument Valley Park, Dorchester Park, hundreds of homes, railroad lines, and business buildings, was under virtual martial law last night. Dozens of homes in the low-lying areas were lifted from their foundations and moved. A few were carried as far as 300 and 400 feet. Others crashed into huge trees as they whirled along the crest of the waters, being seriously damaged. Still others, less strongly built, collapsed entirely. Monument Valley Park, until yesterday, one of the city's beautiful recreation areas, and Dorchester Park were almost completely ravaged by the waters. Cost of replacing them probably will be tens of thousands of dollars. Though declaring the flood that struck Colorado Springs yesterday a major catastrophe, E.L. Mosley, city manager, said last night that no estimate of accuracy could be made on behalf of the city until a survey had been made of the ravaged area today. Although we know that major damage was done to gas, light, and water systems, to parks, and to homes, we have no accurate knowledge of the extent of the damage, Mr. Mosley said. We know that Monument Valley Park, Dorchester Park, and the north part of Colorado Springs suffered extremely heavy loss. Mr. Mosley said that the city council would be called into special session sometime today so that it might receive a report on the damage. The municipal steam plant had 7 feet of water in its basement tonight, he said. No estimate of the damage can be made until it has been surveyed. Despite the excessive flood damage, electric power and light was furnished to parts of Colorado Springs last night by the city's two hydroelectric plants, one of which is situated in Manitou and the other at Ruxton Park on the south side of Pikes Peak. Service was restored in the northeast and the central business sections, but there was none to the east and south. Ivy Wild and Broadmoor, suburbs and Fountain, 10 miles south of here, which receive electricity from Colorado Springs, were without power. Preparations for repairing damages were begun soon after the floodwater struck. Mr. Mosley was high in his praise of work done by rescue and patrol squads. I want to say that they've all been wonderful. Police, firemen, legionnaires, reserve officers, civilian conservation corps workers, Boy Scouts, transient camp men, and citizens. All bridges across Monument and Fountain Creeks in the city except the Bijou Street Viaduct across Monument Creek were destroyed. For hours yesterday, when the water was at its height, it was impossible to use the Bijou Street structure as the flood ran between 5 and 6 feet deep across the thoroughfare at its west end. Not until 6 o'clock last night were 6 women and 2 men on a roof and several others in a tree near the washed-out South Nevada Avenue Bridge rescued. Rockets were shot from shore carrying a line. With this, a rope was drawn across with an axe to chop a hole in the roof to make it secure. Brave men then plunged in and fought their way to the isolated house. This method of rescue was used time after time yesterday. Bodies of 2 victims of Thursday's raging waters were found by searchers yesterday, lodged in flood-deposited flotsam in the now-lowering Fountain Creek, several miles south of Colorado Springs. The bodies were those of Mrs. Emma B. Clark, 58, of 419 Cooper Avenue, and Dominic Cimino, 41, of 519 East Brookside, Ivy Wild. Mrs. Clark was swept into the flood at Bijou Street, along with Mrs. Robert T. Kennedy, with whom she had been riding in an automobile. For a time, the women clung to each other, but Mrs. Kennedy's hold slipped and she grasped a mattress floating past her, managing to keep her head above water until she reached a telephone pole, from which she was rescued. Mrs. Clark was unable to seize anything and is believed to have drowned immediately. Cimino, whose body was found by his cousins Tom and Lee Pinello on the Pinello Ranch, 7 miles south of Colorado Springs, went to his death because he was deaf. He saw Virgil Wolfbarger, who had been driving a truck, marooned in the rising flood and attempted to rescue him. Cimino was on horseback, and when he saw Wolfbarger's plight, or what he regarded as his plight, he immediately rode into the rushing waters, not hearing Wolfbarger, who shouted to him not to enter the stream. Wolfbarger saw a way to escape, that by proceeding in a certain direction, he could wade to land, which he later did. Failing to hear the marooned man's shouts, Cimino rode on, only to be swirled away with his horse a moment later. The body of the horse was found only 50 feet from its owner, pinned under 2 logs.
That was Craig Richardson exploring the pages of the Colorado Springs Gazette, printed in the days following Colorado Springs' most destructive flood on Memorial Day, 1935.
Me, oh me. Oh my, oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
Thanks for joining us this month for Western Skies. We'll see you next month when we talk about open space. But we want to hear from you. What's on your mind? Send us an email at westernskies@krcc.org or give us a call at 719-434-3657. Western Skies is a production of KRCC News and The Big Something with producers Andrea Chalfin, Noel Black, and Craig Richardson. Special thanks to The Haunted Wind Chimes for our theme music with lyrics and arrangement by Anea Lujan. For KRCC News and Western Skies, I'm Andrea Chalfin.